Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and a pen to take notes during the show. First, as is always, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From Seattle, Starbucks Corp. said this week that it would cut as many as 6,700 jobs as it closes hundreds more stores and eliminates more positions at its corporate headquarters. Faced with slowing demand for lattes and cappuccinos because of the recession, Starbucks plans to close 300 stores, including 200 in the United States, and eliminate about 6,000 store jobs. The company also plans to eliminate about 700 corporate jobs, including about 350 at its corporate headquarters in Seattle. Starbucks is also reporting that its profit dropped 69% in its fiscal first quarter. From the Wall Street Journal, massive increase in defaults on jumbo residential mortgage loans. About 6.9% of prime jumbo loans were at least 90 days delinquent in December, according to LPS Applied Analytics, a mortgage data research firm. The rate was up sharply from 2.6% a year earlier. In comparison, delinquencies of non-jumbo prime loans that qualify for backing by government agencies climbed to 2.1% from 0.0% in December 2007. Conforming loan limits top out at $625,000 in the highest cost housing markets. To buy a more expensive home, buyers must pick up larger down payments between 30% and 40% and pay higher mortgage rates now. Rates on 30-year fixed jumbo mortgages stood at 6.87% last week compared to 5.34% for conforming mortgages, a difference of 1.53 percentage points, according to HSH Associates, a financial publisher. And from CNN.com senior producer Wayne Drash, the story is From $80,000 a Year to Eviction, Hard Times in America. Amber Easton has gone from $80,000 a year in salary to scrambling for work. At a time in her life when she should be scaling the corporate ladder, she has spiraled into a deep depression. She recently lost her car and now faces eviction. I never imagined that I would be in such a situation at my age, said Amber Easton, 35. Last week, the 35-year-old longtime working professional attended two job fairs with friends in the Detroit area. They stood in line for over 3 hours with hundreds of professionals of all types. It was a real eye-opener to see the caliber of people we were in line with, very educated with vast skill sets, Easton said. Afterwards, we went to the restaurant located in the same hotel, and it was filled with unemployed professionals sharing their story, from engineers to graphic designers to marketing professionals. Easton's saga began in July 2007, when she traded in her job as a corporate compliance officer to attend law school, what she thought would help advance her career. But after a year out of law school, she decided it was not for her. By then, her old job was gone and the job market had shrunk. It's hard not to be depressed during a time like this, she wrote. I never imagined in a million years that I would be in such a situation at my age and at this point in my career. I am humiliated. I am praying for everyone else out there who is facing the same problems. She has applied to 70 different companies, but gotten few leads. She recently went through a rigorous interview process for one job in another state, but to no avail. Every day, she searches for new job possibilities, and every day results in more desperation. She estimates she's making $20,000, if that, as a contract employee working from her home. I just haven't made enough to keep up. Her Detroit neighborhood a couple years ago was booming, she said, but now it's like a ghost town around here. It's bad everywhere, but it's so, so bad here, she said. Across the nation, people like Easton are feeling the pinch. Good jobs have evaporated. Former full-time employees are now working part-time contract positions just to get by. Nearly 2.6 million jobs were lost during 2008, the highest yearly total since the end of World War II in 1945. Last week alone, major corporations have announced more than 80,000 job cuts, bringing this year's total to well over 200,000. Dr. Rosalind Dorlin is a clinical psychologist in Summit, New Jersey, an area she calls a, quote, Wall Street ghetto, where formerly high-flying executives are out of work. Here the people earn millions of dollars with bonuses that are astronomical, said Dorlin, who is also the public education coordinator in New Jersey for the American Psychological Association. There is a demoralizing aspect to having a huge salary and a huge bonus, and then having to look for a job that is going to pay much, much less. She added, "What I'm hearing is a terrible sense of betrayal, anxiety, and people experiencing lots of stress. That, in turn, can lead to an increase in unhealthy coping behaviors, such as an uptick in alcohol consumption, unhealthy eating, and worse sleeping habits." Dorlin has several tips for people out of work. Those tips are: don't panic, find a support group, even if it's just an informal group of friends, seek employment counseling when available, be professional in your job hunt, network with other professionals, take time to exercise during hard times, spend valuable time with your family. On a practical note, she said people should contact their creditors to let them know the situation. She also advises people to do volunteer work and to cultivate a spirit of optimism. Bad times pass, and it's sometimes hard to see that when you're in the throes of a terrible place, the bad times will pass. I think we do need to hold on to a spirit of optimism and a sense of confidence. CNN's user-generated site, iReport.com, has been flooded with messages from people out of work. One woman held up her husband's resume and said, "Please, please, please take him off my hands. My husband can knock out a honey-do list like nobody's business, and he meets my great high standards every day. Don't let my husband slip through your hands. He would be a great addition to your team," the woman said under the headline, "Wife Seeking Job for Husband." In Delaware, Manoj Philip, 24, said he had a full-time job in 2007, making about $55,000 a year, including all the perks and benefits that came with it. But in July 2007, he quit the job to pursue a career in real estate. "I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but I didn't think it would be this tough," he said. By September 2008, Philip needed a second income because of the withering housing market. He picked up a full-time contracting job and continues to do real estate about 20 to 30 hours per week. "It was a shock," he said, "to return to full-time work while putting his real estate dreams on hold. It took a lot for me to change that mental outlook, because before I would have thought of it as something holding me back," Philip said. "But I don't look at it like that anymore." He's since learned the value of living within his means, budgeting, and making every dollar he spends count for something. "There are really important lessons to learn. I'm glad I learned at such a young age," he said. In Detroit, Easton said she knows America will bounce back at some point, but in the meantime, People are losing everything. That's what scares me, she said. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And in the second part of the show, we'll continue with looking at love and money, talking about relationships and the effect of money on relationships and how to cope with money to make that relationship healthy and strong on one upper level, and on the other lower level to certainly not make it into a problem or fatal bullet for a relationship. And again, I'd like to start out with my credit. The thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Emilian Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. And I also suggest that you look at the www.kruufm.com archives and go to Life in Debt so you can get a total picture of everything we've been talking about in this show based on Professor Warren's works and how it's built up to this point where we're going to speak today about the 8 golden rules of money and relationships. And I first want to start out with what I was discussing last week, which is rule number 1, what's mine is ours. And just as an aside, recognize that the relationship I'm talking about here is your principal intimate relationship, your spouse, your partner, your live-in person. Doesn't matter, as long as it's a long-term connected relationship and everything is commingled, including money. So what's mine is ours is this question, and we're leading to this concept of thinking about how to strengthen the relationship. And then the issue came up about money and marriage, having one bank account or two. And the point is that it really doesn't matter, that there are a lot more problematic issues in a relationship and in the money concerns in a relationship that you would have to be concerned about. And people do organize in very different ways. Some people like to organize one way, with files and everything is isolated. Others like to put things together. And that really doesn't matter if a person, or I should say a couple, has one account or two. Is it all ours or can I still have mine is really the question. You want to talk about my account and your account, my money and your money, then you have a problem if you are in a spiritual or legal quote-unquote marriage, as we're talking about. Your lives are together. They're not separate. You promised to be together, whether it's before a justice of the peace, a priest, a rabbi, however, or just in your hearts together, a common law kind of marriage relationship. The money should not be separate. Your bank accounts can be separate, but your money should not be separate in the ultimate sense. There needs to be an integration, and that's a very important thing. Everything is ours. First of all, as I mentioned last week, that's true. Certainly, if you are legally married by law, whether it's a community property state or not, people do get everything placed together from a court's point of view and from the law's point of view. Even if there was a breakup, there is generally an equitable distribution of all of the assets. And so while you're looking at the money situation, don't only look at the asset side of it. The debt side of it belongs to both of you. And of course, the decisions about the money certainly belong to both of you. Realistically, it's just not possible for one of you to be poor while the other is rich. That's not in any way good situation to try to set up. In a marriage, that's a lifetime commitment. If one of them is one of the people in the marriage is going to retire in comfort while the other is poor, that's not a very good strategy. And one person can't live in a mansion while the other person is homeless out in the street. In short, you're married and so is your money. And that's a really important bottom line concept. So why should you be obligated if at this point in your financial situation, you've gone through this course, you've read Professor Warren's books, and you're doing everything that you possibly can to improve the situation while your partner isn't? You are feeling obligated to improvement, but the other person doesn't seem obligated at this point. It's important that you don't keep score like this, because that will make you both losers. As I said before, you are in control of your side of it, and you change what you can. You don't nag, you don't complain, you don't look at everything as being quote-unquote fair and unfair in one isolated part of the relationship like money. You don't do that because that is the slippery slope to destroying the relationship. The essential point is that this kind of partnership, marriage, isn't based on fairness. It's based on sharing. You share your home, you share your lives, you share your money, and you share health, you share sickness, for better or for worse. That is really the bottom line in making a relationship work. So we believe in relationships, we believe in lifelong relationships, and we believe in life. The name of the show is Life and Debt. And all of that works out a lot better when you pool your money and don't worry too much about yours and mine. That is not going to work. So back to the original issue of joint checking accounts. The account is under both names, you both have access, and you both know where you stand financially. That's generally the wisest approach. And as we have learned in this course, the bare necessities, which are your essential fixed costs and expenses every month, and your savings, which is 20% of your net monthly income, those are going to be standard. Those are going to be set. So when you have a joint account, then you're really pretty much set up. There's not a lot of leeway there. You're just writing checks for basic bills and things you've already budgeted to meet the expenses. You have agreed to all of this ahead of time, so you don't have to squabble over little kinds of purchases. You keep your $1,000 cushion in that joint checking account. That's to make sure that there's some latitude just in case something goes a little bit awry. And your checking account statement should look roughly the same every month. Paychecks going in, a certain amount of cash for the bare necessities, and a fixed amount going into savings. That's all preconceived, set up in a joint account. Now, there are certain relationships where people just really want to have their own separate checking accounts, and that's not bad, but it's okay, as we said, if you meet a few conditions. Those conditions are you need to both know where you stand financially. It's not okay to use separate accounts to keep secrets. Second point is that you both must accept 100% responsibility. It's not okay to use separate accounts as an excuse for her credit card balance is her problem, or I covered my bills, so why should I worry? The money and the bills still belong to both of you, even if you find it more convenient to manage from separate accounts. And then the last thing is you make the big decisions together. There's going to be some separate money in the wants category, where you just have basically money for you to buy the things that are small, your shoes, your going out to a dinner with your friends, going bowling, whatever it is that you want to do personally. But that's not okay for the big expenses like the new car, a retirement account, the amounts of money that you're going to put into a home. There's no way that you can continue on and not agree on the big decisions. You have to keep on talking until you find a reasonable compromise when a big decision comes up, because you have a joint financial future, whether your accounts are together or separate. You need to work together and That means work together on the plans that will have a major impact on your lives. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Lipczak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Again, coming back to this concept of the relationship is considered a long-term, lifetime endeavor. And as I mentioned in the past, that certainly the superficial values like money, materialism, physicality, all of these things are part of a relationship. The intellectual values are part of a relationship. The emotional values are part of a relationship. And the egotistical values are part of a relationship, as are the spiritual values. So each one of these levels have to have some kind of compatibility. And the fact that you have made a commitment to this person because you love them means that the vast majority of those levels do comport with each other. Over time, they may change some, but that's part of the progress and the growth process that we are living to learn, and to learn how to eventually come together in a totally spiritual way, in my personal opinion. And that means on all these different levels, from the deep spiritual side to the gross physical side, and beyond to the reciprocal side in the world. So you need to have that as the definition for the kind of relationship that I'm talking about here, where you are going to look at all these different things ultimately. And money is one thing that has so much attention on it right now in our personal lives and in our time frame in the world, that the money can overshadow every other level. This superficial point can overshadow every other level. And that's not healthy, that's not good, and it's not going to maintain that relationship, which is really a key fundamental value to life itself. For those kinds of personalities that we call householders, and that's a vast majority of the people on the planet who are adults. So that was point one of the golden rules: what's mine is ours. That's the financial side of it, but that also includes everything. And that really does help to define a relationship. Golden rule number two, then, continuing on this week, is be truthful and make it easy for your partner to be truthful too. We know that a good relationship is based on trust, but it is easy, particularly in the current two-person working kind of scenario and market that we have, it's easy to hide things like credit card bills, to overstate how much you've been saving, to forget what things cost. So we have a few secrets here from our partner, a few quote-unquote white lies there, and life seems to be a lot smoother. You don't have to explain yourself. You don't have to defend anything. You don't have to worry that your partner will use the information against you later on. Well, that's a mistake right from the beginning with respect to money in a relationship. So Professor Warren gives a little self-test. Are you and your partner truthful about money? So respond true or false to the following statements. It seems so much easier just not to mention what I spend money on. True or false? I have borrowed money or run up debts without telling my partner. True or false? I have discovered things that my partner bought that I didn't know about. True or false? I have hidden money from my partner. True or false? I don't know how much credit card debt my partner owes. True or false? I don't really know how much money my partner makes. True or false? We just never talk about money. That's the last one. True or false? Now, according to Professor Warren and Amelia, if you marked true for any of these statements, you have a problem with openness and honesty in your money partnership. We think a few little lies don't hurt, or do they? Well, after a while, they do. You have a lot of threads to keep up with, intellectually trying to put everything together. A lot of things your partner doesn't know about, you find yourself telling bigger lies just to keep up.
you aren't bad. People who do this aren't fundamentally bad. In fact, you probably have the best intentions in the world, but there is more and more in your relationship that isn't quite true when you get into this kind of spin. So you can't be evading, you can't be covering up, you can't be in denial. None of these things are going to work. Mistrust and evasions over money can be one of the most difficult cycles to break in a relationship. After all, if your partner isn't honest about money, then you say, well, why should I be? Well, there is just one reason, because it's the only way to save your relationship and to build a stronger, powerful relationship. Really and truly, mistrusting your partner about money is no different from mistrusting your partner about anything else. Suspicion will eat away at your relationship day after day. So, what's the solution? What do you do? Well, you certainly can't control your partner, but you can decide that from now on, you will be totally honest with him or her about money, no matter what. No more lying, no more cover-up, no more hiding receipts or holding back on how much overtime pay you received, trying to hide, have a little separate stash of money on the side. Just the truth, plain and simple. That's what we're looking for here. And the other half of that commitment, the one that makes all the difference between good intentions and real success, is make it easy on your partner to be truthful. You may not be able to force him or her to tell the truth, but you can promise that you will never belittle that person, never make him or her feel bad, never criticize when the truth comes out. So you're cultivating a style of interacting that is totally, absolutely honest on all levels financially. And that is a very, very important point in keeping that relationship moving forward in a progressive way. Because that really is what that partnership is all about. That's what marriage is all about, right? Exactly. Sticking it out for better or for worse. You want to be sympathetic. And that means this is really hard for both of us sometimes, particularly financially, but I'm at least going to be very, very good about honesty and about not putting my partner down. So get honest. Ultimately, you can't hide money decisions from your most intimate partner. You have the things you bought. You owe the money you borrowed. If you keep adding to the lies, then someday it will all crash down around you. You have to make the decision right here, right now, to tell the truth, and then resolve to make it easy for your partner to tell the truth too. If you do, you'll do better with money, and you'll do better with each other, which is what this is all about. So that's golden rule number two: be truthful and make it easy for your partner to be truthful too. And next week, we'll look at rule number three: stop playing the blame game. Then in the following weeks, rule four: give each other some free money. Rule five: keep money issues separate from the real stuff. Rule six: fight fair. Rule seven: divide and conquer. And the last golden rule: learn the art of compromise. So those are some points that we will be going deeply into in the future shows. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.